Welcome back to Advancing Nitrogen Smart, the special podcast series from University of Minnesota Extension. I'm Jack Wilcox at the Communications Desk here with Extension. Now, you probably noticed the new music. We're starting 2025 with a fresh coat of paint, so don't worry, you're in the right place. Today in episode 15, we're going to take a big picture look at nitrogen conservation. We spend a lot of time talking about water quality issues. What are some solutions? The subject is important and there's a lot to talk about, so we're going to divide this episode into two parts, the first today and the second part 2 weeks from now. Brad Carlson, Extension Educator, joins us as always. You'll recognize him. Today we have Jeff Vetch joining us. Jeff is a researcher at the Southern Research and Outreach Center in Waseca, Minnesota, and he's a regular on the Nutrient Management Podcast. Brad, let's jump right in where conservation relates to water quality. What can be reasonably achieved?
Yeah, Jack. Well, we spend an awful lot of time talking about kind of what the issues are water quality wise and what's causing them and so forth. You know, we're at a point now where we're starting to really focus a lot on what the solutions are. The state's been busy dealing with its nutrient reduction strategy that came out a number of years ago, but it's currently being rewritten. And really that's focusing on what kind of practices are potentially going to make some improvements in water quality. And I think it's worth noting all of these practices and these changes will, I don't want to say necessarily equally impact, but they both impact surface and groundwater. So in places where we have surface water issues, in places where we have groundwater issues, you know, really the solutions are kind of the same. We tend to have different landscapes in those places, but a lot of the, you know, nitrogen is still nitrogen, you know, and our crops are still kind of what they are. So a lot of this stuff will pull double duty. You know, I think the one area that we need to really understand is kind of a baseline or foundation of understanding with this whole issue of nitrogen loss in the environment is that a lot of this stuff is coming from natural sources. So there's long-term research done at Waseca, and the particular data set that we use during our Nitrogen Smart presentations has Giles Randall and Jeff Vetch quoted from a journal article from 2011, and we got Jeff here with us today, that looks at some four-year totals. And I think the point we like to emphasize with this is that when we apply zero nitrogen, or when we grow soybeans for which we apply zero nitrogen, we're still losing nitrogen through the tile lines. And if you kind of take some long-term averages, it comes out to be about 10 pounds an acre. And so, you know, really that's the result of our annual cropping systems. We have crops that we plant in the spring and they die in the fall, but we're looking at what's happening year round. And so there's big parts of the year where there's no roots or anything else to impede the nitrogen from getting out. And if you look at that data, even in cases where we're applying the best management practice rates for nitrogen, that loss, it goes up to roughly about 15 pounds an acre on average. And so, you know, the whole quandary of this all is if you did a 30% reduction and it would meaning like literally not applying nitrogen anymore, it's a 30% reduction. And we're looking at trying to achieve a 45% reduction to meet these surface water quality goals. And so it really kind of tells us that nitrogen fertilizer management alone isn't going to be the solution to this.
Yeah, and part of that's related to it being a natural system and nitrogen being in the system from mineralization from organic matter. And the other factor is in our row crop production is that the majority of our drainage comes in the spring after snowmelt and after early season rainfall, and there's no crop activity or uptake of N at that time. And that's the period of time when a lot of that loss occurs. So even the only way you could circumvent that would be a perennial system.
Yeah, and so, I mean, there's been a lot, you know, bannered about, not certainly not in the farm press, because I think that segment understands, but when you look at some of the stuff that's been out in the general media, really is demonizing nitrogen fertilizer as the big part of this problem. Realistically, that's not really where the problem lies. And, you know, I don't want to sit here and say, oh, we've got all these problems with corn and soybeans. However, I mean, it is really an artifact of the fact that we're growing annual crops. And so we're looking at needing to do with those annual crops in rotation, you know, we're going to have to find some solutions beyond nitrogen management to address this. If you look at the broad categories of the practices that have been suggested in the past, there's really like three big chunks. You know, one is the fertilizer management part, and the next is dealing with landscape and cropping systems, things like cover crops or changing our crop rotations, potentially looking at incorporating perennials into our cropping systems. And then the last one that we're currently calling edge of field practices. For a long time, we've called it conservation drainage, but we've kind of added some more stuff into it. You know, these are kind of the engineering practices that involve intercepting the water and doing some treatment on them.
Yeah, and the ideal thing is when you look at these things, there's some that fit really well in certain circumstances, some that maybe aren't going to fit in some fields or some areas of the geography of the state and of the Midwest. And then there's some that maybe can, when stacked together, could be even more beneficial.
And we're going to probably have to combine practices because, like we said, you know, we could eliminate nitrogen fertilizer and only get a 30% reduction, not a 45%. And so, you know, something else is going to have to happen with that. I think it's kind of worth noting, you know, we're not going to spend a lot of time here talking about cover crops and edge of field practices. We will cover that in detail on some different podcasts. But you know, part of the problem with some of that stuff is it's still a work in progress. You know, that some of the engineering practices are expensive. And some of the cover crop and crop rotation stuff, we don't really have the recipe, if you will, on how to do that and make it function. If you look at the report that came out in 2013, the nitrogen in Minnesota surface waters that the Pollution Control Agency put out, there was an economic model that Bill Lazarus, one of our ag economists, helped develop. And it looked at the costs of some of these practices, and I think the thing that and this is kind of a oh duh, but it's really worth noting that nitrogen fertilizer management is head and shoulders the cheapest thing we can do to address this, because just simply by its nature, being more efficient with nitrogen as an input, meaning only applying what you need to apply and therefore probably purchasing less of it, and then, you know, potentially increasing yields because, you know, maybe you changed your timing or you were using a practice that wasn't desirable. That stuff puts money in your pocket. You know, it increases yields, it reduces expenses. All the other practices that we employ cost money. It costs a lot of money to install these edge of field engineering practices, it's going to cost a lot of money, you know, if we're going to start putting cover crops in all over the place. And, you know, and of course, some of the issues with that, as I already mentioned, that we don't have a lot of the practices worked out, is also going to be varying performance. You know, in particular, like the cost of establishing a cover crop or planting a cover crop in a year that we've got an early fall and it gets really cold and then it doesn't ever grow. Now you've got an expense that almost literally didn't even produce any results. And then that starts looking really expensive.
And some of these have big numbers. You know, they don't reduce a lot of nitrogen and they have a bigger, you know, upfront ticket cost. Like you said, the edge of the field practices, that not only do they have a bigger cost, but it's all upfront. And then you gain from it and years later. And that upfront cost, if it's not cost shared or some part of a program, that can be a challenge. You have to realize that all these practices and all these things are not suitable on every acre. And there's a certain area where that's a great fit, other areas where it's not such a great fit. And that's why stacking things and figuring out where they work and where they don't work is going to be necessary if we get even close to these goals.
Well, that's right, Jeff. I mean, as you know, you think about the places in the state where we've got groundwater issues, you know, our sandy soils, and then get into the southeast where we've got lust soils and shallow bedrock and so forth. And there's not a lot of tile drainage. So like a lot of these edge of field practices are designed to intercept tile water and treat it. Well, if you don't have tile water, then you can't even use those things.
And, exactly.
You know, so that's also important to remember. You know, the other thing though that I like to stress about this is farmers are fairly keenly aware of what they pay for their nitrogen fertilizer. So if you start thinking about, you know, if you're paying 50 cents a pound or something like that to purchase fertilizer, and now you start looking at these practices that are costing $1.50, $2, $6 a pound to get it back out of the water, it's really kind of emphasizes the need to not be applying unnecessary fertilizer. I mean, it goes beyond the fact that being efficient with your fertilizer inputs is profitable for your farming. You know, it kind of then goes past the, you know, my year-end tax statement and say, in the long run, if I'm going to have to also pay to get this back out of the water and it didn't need to be there in the first place, it gets really expensive. Yeah, you know, there's been some evolution in some of this stuff as far as what it actually costs. Like I said, some of it's a work in progress. I think the cover crop one has really been kind of difficult to nail down, because if you look at just automatically planting cover crops everywhere, I think we recognize that they'll fail in most places, and then it's just a big sunk expense that produces no results. And cover crops don't have to be really expensive if we are strategic about putting them in places where they're likely to succeed. And so that cost can be quite variable, and it's very similar to some of these other practices too, as far as being strategic with where they go.
As you mentioned, there's areas where they don't succeed, and there's areas where you're used as common practice. So those things have to be put into perspective as you develop a plan that's going to work for an individual field or an individual farm or a geographic region.
Yeah, and the other thing we have to recognize is, and we're sitting here talking about nitrogen, is that some of these practices have other benefits. You know, the one that looked really bad on Bill's analysis was riparian buffers or buffer strips. But we know that buffer strips aren't really being put in place to prevent nitrogen from getting in the water. I mean, the main benefit you're getting from there is you're taking some cropland out of row crop production, which of course, you know, then you're putting a deep rooted perennial in. So the loss in that buffer strip itself goes to almost zero. And maybe there's some shallow groundwater that's intercepted, but for the most part, you know, that practice is intended to stop soil erosion and intercept phosphorus. And, you know, similarly with cover crops, you know, we're looking at some of these other soil health improvements that have other benefits also. And so, you know, we do need to be a little careful about not getting all caught up on the cost of these strictly for nitrogen if they do have multiple benefits. The thing, though, that I really do like to stress to farmers is, and this kind of comes off of Bill's analysis in the PCA document, is he went through and kind of estimated, at least based on what we think is going on as far as changes in nitrogen management that could be happening, reducing rates, switching timing, using inhibitors in places where they're appropriate, you know, whatever those practices might be. And his estimate was that statewide, farmers are leaving $77 million a year on the table, you know, in terms of either reduced expenses or increased profits. And that's important to recognize. However, when he went into place, when it went into the other practices and started estimating what they cost, you know, and maybe I should mention that his estimate, at least from some of this stuff, and Dave Mala worked with him on some of these reductions, was that we almost got to a 15% reduction if we did everything everywhere we could nitrogen management wise. But then if we turn around and we start putting in these edge of field practices, these drainage related things, he was estimating a $74 million cost statewide for that. And that, again, that's an annual cost. So basically you were taking all your savings from nitrogen management and you're turning it back out and paying it back out in the expense of putting in these edge of field practices. That didn't quite get us to 20%. So then when we start looking at some of the vegetation changes, which includes things like literally taking sensitive land out of production, which that takes your profit from whatever your profit is and turns it to zero because you're not growing crops there anymore and so forth, that stuff got exceedingly expensive. I mean, the number Bill came up with was $1.4 billion a year. I mean, that's just a crazy number, and it was per year. I mean, that wasn't a one-time expense. You know, I guess really the take-home message is not so much to dwell on those numbers, but really to look at the nitrogen management side of this and say, as an industry, like, this is so far and away the easiest thing we can do to address this problem. Everything else gets exceptionally expensive after that point.
Yeah, and what I would add is that, you know, the cost savings and of the nitrogen management practices, you know, can get us 13, 14% reduction. And that's not only, you know, something that can be done fairly easily, but it can be done on a large number of acres. Where you look at the tile drainage BMPs, as we mentioned before, and you've got a lot fewer acres across the Corn Belt that you're going to be able to implement those types of practices on. So even though the percent reduction is smaller, it's because you have a lot fewer acres that you can use them in. The other thing that I would add, though, when we look at fertilizer management optimization, the biggest challenge with that is the weather. You know, and that does throw a curveball, and it didn't for a lot of growers this spring, in particular in South Central Minnesota, Northern Iowa. So it does take extra management, even though we perceive it as kind of a no-brainer. You can make more money and you're going to get this benefit not only agronomically, but also environmentally. It takes very detailed management to deal with these things as you have weather that makes it challenging and increases nitrogen losses. Or if you're coming off a couple drought years and you think you got carryover N out there.
And it really kind of comes back to the whole premise of Nitrogen Smart, and that is to understand how nitrogen is behaving, and then also understand the dynamics of your production system, your field, your soils, the weather, and then make the best management decisions as you go along. It's a very difficult thing for a lot of farmers, particularly if you get to a certain size, because you really want to or need to streamline your operations to be efficient. However, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, I mean, the ideal would be to be adapting your management on an annual basis to kind of match what's given you. And even that doesn't work, Jeff, because, you know, we look at a year ago, and the fall of 2023 was dry, and we were saying, well, if there's ever a good year to put on fall nitrogen, this is it, because we got this big water deficit. The odds of losing this nitrogen aren't really high. And then it got unbelievably wet in the early summer of 2024, and lo and behold, we did lose most of that nitrogen. So even then, you know, we don't have the crystal ball to figure this out.
What is ironic, though, is when we look at the green part, the vegetative changes, is they're kind of weatherproof. That cropping system change usually works no matter what the weather is.
Right.
And that is a key factor to think of, even though economically, from a land use, you know, return on investment, it's a dramatic change, but it does work dependent no matter what the weather.
It does. And you know, this is a long-term solution if we're starting to look at that. I mean, there's been some people have bandied about the idea of like, well, we need to just retire sensitive land or so forth. I mean, I did the math, and this is actually part of one of our different Advanced Nitrogen Smart presentations, but if we were going to achieve water quality goals strictly on the basis of either land retirement, like putting into CRP, or having a perennial crop on that land, I mean, we would have to devote literally one third of our cropland in Minnesota. I mean, that's just not a solution either. And so it's going to have to be something comprehensive. Let's change gears a little, Jeff, and I want to talk particularly about some stuff that you've had your fingers in over the years, and that's kind of going then over to the side of the nitrogen management stuff and some of the technologies and the tools that have been out there to try and help advise us or be very precise or even site specific variable rate and so forth within a field. Really, there's three major kind of categories, the way I see it, of this kind of technology. We've got the sensor stuff that's looking at the crop. There's models that are intended to predict what's happening out there in your field and the environment. And then we've got the, some testing technology.
Yeah, I think that the sensors have been around for quite a while. I mean, probably going on over 20 years now or more. The in-season testing, I think that's where we're going to see some changes, because I think you're going to see sensors move more into in-season testing and having sensors maybe that test in the soil or sensors that test using different techniques than we've had in the past.
Yeah, you know, some of this, this is really high technology because, you know, there's really, you know, if you really get down into the nitty-gritty of it, you know, there's really only a few things that can be measured. You know, like electricity can be measured. And so if you're looking at passing some electrical pulse and seeing some change in that, light can be measured. And so you're passing a light beam through something, you're measuring differences in the light beam. You know, a lot of this gets back to what can we actually measure or sense as we're literally going through the field. And then how do we interpret that? And one of the big issues historically has been interference with the signal you're looking for. And I know, like, for instance, you know, one of the big problems, and this is, again, this is getting way into the weeds, but one of the big problems with sensing nitrate in water has in on a real-time basis has always been the fact that when you pass light through it and you're looking at absorption of different chemicals based on what they absorb in the light spectrum, nitrate is the same as bromide. And so, which is just totally unrelated, you know, but the problem is then if you want to get a nitrate number, you've got to also calculate bromide, which is not important to anybody, but you need that number so you can subtract it off the top to get nitrate. And some of this stuff gets really complicated in that way.
Yeah, and the active and passive sensors, you know, they work best when the crop starts telling a good story. The challenge is then that timing of how fast you can turn around and make that application is the limiting factor, and that's where it gets difficult.
Yeah, I know you've worked a lot with the active sensors. I think the one most people are familiar with is Green Seeker, but there's been a lot of these products that have been out there for quite a long time. They, you know, they seem good because technically you could mount one of these things on the front of an applicator and you could be reading the crop condition on the front and applying fertilizer right out the back as you're driving across the field. And so they are relatively timely, and they can be relatively inexpensive. You buy that thing right up front. I mean, assuming you've already got a fertilizer spreader and it's got the ability to adjust its rate on the fly, you know, you're not talking about a great expense of a unit there. But, you know, the problem we've had a long time with sensors is when we see a change in the crop canopy, for instance, with your own eyes, that when it turns yellow, did you already lose yield? You know, and so is it too late? And then in addition to that, you know, how do we calibrate? You can see that it's yellow, but what does that actually mean with respect to how much nitrogen you need to apply?
Yeah, you know, developing the algorithm or the recommendation is the challenging part, and it can be affected by genetics. Crop genetics can change it. The soil, you know, separating the color of the soil or the background color with the crop color is a challenge. And actually, they've developed some really interesting software that does that. But these are all things that hurdles that they have to get over. And, you know, in your last con is the application may be too late. That's the challenging part. You know, take a spring like this spring, and if you were going to delay a lot of your N management this spring, until mid to late Sidra, say V8 to V12. We had extraordinarily saturated fields at that time that were almost impassable with conventional ground equipment. How would we have ever gotten significant amount of nitrogen fertilizer on those fields? And then the risk that you take on by delaying that application and relying on that, you know, entire or a very high percentage of your N is applied at side dress versus up front. That's taking on a lot of risk as a grower, especially on poorly drained soils.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned crop genetics, and you know, that's another thing I think is worth talking about. That, you know, for one thing, some of these products have been used successfully in other crops. They've been used in small grains, winter wheat, I think, particularly in southern areas. And so, you know, there's been the want, like, well, if it can work there, why can't it work elsewhere? But there's also been things relative to long season corn hybrids, like we don't grow up north, you know, 115 to 120 day and longer corn hybrids have a longer window to avoid sensitivity loss. I mean, when we're dealing with a 95 day hybrid in Minnesota, you know, the time period that passes by where all of a sudden you've lost yield is very short. And so, you know, that's been really problematic for us.
But I think the places where they can work in Minnesota ag or the upper Midwest is certainly on, we've got a lot of irrigated acres. I mean, they have a fit there because you have the ability to put fertilizer on and water it in and make sure it becomes active right away. They can work in that environment. And then as a rescue treatment, and obviously this spring was a year when we had a ton of fields that needed a rescue treatment. And we've seen that the genetics are changing a little bit and more of the N is taken up in new corn genetics after flowering than it used to be. So there's probably still reasons to go out there and do some of these later mid-season before tasseling rescues than we would have probably recommended in the past, especially if we think we can get some moisture to help get them incorporated into the plant.
And you know, it's worth noting, Jeff, that's a viable use of this technology. However, it's not nitrogen management. It's being reactive to an environmental problem. You know, we hope to never go into the season saying, well, what are we going to do for a rescue treatment this year? Because if you're dealing with a rescue treatment on an annual basis, you probably got some long-term problems with your farm. You know, the other thing about it is, you know, we already talked about this a little bit when we talked about the loss of nitrogen, even when we apply zero fertilizer, and the fact that that's coming from how much nitrogen is being mineralized in the organic matter of our soils is, you know, we do have the ability in Minnesota to supply a lot of nitrogen from the middle of the growing season on, particularly provided it's not all saturated, if we get decently warm days and sunshine and so forth. And so in some cases you can pick up these yellow colors and it truly is a nitrogen deficiency. However, you don't get a response to the fertilizer applied because that's the time of year the soil kicks in and starts supplying it anyway. And so it didn't really matter.
Extension educator Brad Carlson and researcher Jeff Vetch, thank you for talking with us at the Southern Research and Outreach Center in Waseca. We'll pick up the discussion again in 2 weeks. Do you have a question about something on your farm? Just send us an email here at nutmgmt@umn.edu. Thanks a lot for listening, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Advancing Nitrogen Smart is proud to be supported by the Farm Families of Minnesota and their Corn Checkoff investment through Minnesota Corn.